This is not a normal summer movie season. Theaters are closed, big projects are delayed, and we're missing the flood of new films that would usually have already started. But you don't have to go without movies.
That's because even if you see a lot, you miss even more. We do too, and that's what we're talking about today. Some recent films we missed that are well worth your time. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about movies we missed on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Also with us is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
It's so good to speak to you guys. And as I said, we have not been bombarded with summer movies the way that we normally are. So we decided to check our streaming options. Let's kick it off with Stephen. Stephen, what did you pick?
Well, the initial assignment here was find a great movie that we missed that we didn't talk about on the show. And I was really curious to watch the movie Ad Astra from last fall. That's Brad Pitt shot into space while having dad issues. I watched it in preparation for the show. And on balance, I enjoyed it. It has a gorgeous score by Max Richter. It has these fantastic visuals. There's a battle with space apes that really should have been the whole movie. But I was frustrated by the movie. I thought the script really didn't live up to the visual imagination. I thought it had some really good ideas that weren't necessarily carried out ideally, but it did make me eager to watch another movie about space. And so I watched the documentary Apollo 11. Now, Apollo 11 was considered kind of a frontrunner for the Best Documentary Feature Oscar, and then ended up not getting nominated, and so I ended up not watching it as part of our Oscars prep, and so I sat down and watched it last night. It's streaming on Hulu. You can rent it through Amazon and YouTube and other streaming services, and it is a really compact and gorgeously made retelling of the Apollo 11, the original moon landing with your Neil Armstrong and your Buzz Aldrin. And this documentary, it's making use of a bunch of new footage. There had been obviously a bunch of footage associated with the moon landing, but they found an archive that was shot in 70 millimeter. And it is very, very crisp and beautiful. And you watch it in HD and you're watching 1969, but like it's happening in the present. And that alone, just the visuals, just this treasure trove of new crisp footage is worth sitting down and spending 90 minutes with this movie. But it is also a very subtly and intelligently made retelling. It's not contextualizing the space race. There's no narration. It's not giving you the stakes. You already know the stakes. It's just kind of carrying you through the story as it unfolds. And I will say, it is completely riveting. You know, I was watching Ad Astra, which is set in the future, and he's like jetting off to Neptune, and you're just sitting there like, that couldn't happen. And then watching Apollo 11, I was like, that couldn't happen. And so just watching this documentary play out of real life from 50 years ago, and it still conveys that total sense of wonder and disbelief. I really love it. It's rated G. You can watch it with anybody, Apollo 11.
So, Stephen, I just want to, like, no spoilers, but does it work? Do they land on the moon?
You know, the funny thing is I felt stressed out. I felt stressed out on their behalf. Like, are they going to make it? I checked Wikipedia. I knew that they did.
And just to clarify, zero space apes, right?
Zero space apes. Okay. That was the other thing I was looking for.
I mean, I feel like that's also a spoiler. They get up there and there's not a single space ape. So again, that's Apollo 11. It's streaming on Hulu, and you can also rent it from Amazon or iTunes or a number of places. So that's Steven's pick. Glenn, what did you bring?
I brought Diamantino, D-I-M-A-N-T-I-N-O. This is the weirdest film I've seen in a donkey's age. You know, a lot of cult movies come out of the gate really hot. They're very self-conscious about the fact that they're cult movies. They're tryhards. This movie is weird, and it's kind of a gorgeous mess. But it's not a put-on, right? It's very much of itself. Its weirdness is organic, is how I'd put it. So, Diamantino, played by Carlota Cata, is a star Portuguese soccer player who is not Cristiano Ronaldo. Do not get it twisted. Do not mistake it. It's a completely fictional creation. Who has Ronaldo's hair and his earrings and his abs. It looks a lot like Cristiano Ronaldo, but is not. And he misses a penalty shot in the World Cup, and then the whole world turns against him. So Kata is playing him. It's a very pure, very funny performance because he's playing him as a complete dim bulb, a child, but a very sweet one, a very empathetic one, who knows nothing about the world except soccer, because why would he need to? So consequently, he's constantly being taken advantage of. He's being investigated by this pair of hot lesbian undercover cops for money laundering. He's got a couple of evil twin sisters straight out of a fairy tale who are secretly renting him to a corporation who wants to clone him for a reason that is entirely too silly to go into. There are also, almost forgot, oh yes, giant elephant-sized puppies in this movie. And at the same time, it is weirdly topical because it's tackling the European refugee crisis at a very odd angle. It's dealing with right-wing national politics at an even weirder angle. And there's one sex scene where one cop is dressed as a nun and the other is dressed as a teenage boy. And because so much is going on in this film, it just barely registers. You're like, sure, yeah, why not? I had to pause this movie for some reason at one point, and the screen went black, and I just caught a reflection of my face on the screen, and I had just the doofiest grin. I was like on my big dumb face. It was kind of happy, but puzzled. It's directed by Gabriel Abrantes and Daniel Schmidt, both of whom were born in the States, but I think they both live in Portugal now. They've done a few shorts before together, but this is the first time they've worked together on a feature film. Now, I'm not down with all the choices they make. They use a very grainy film stock for in service of what, I do not know. And Diamantino's narration is wall-to-wall. It's omnipresent, which is, you know, that's a classic first movie crutch. But it had a limited run here in the States. You can rent it as Amazon Prime. You can rent it on iTunes. You know, we see a lot of films for this show, arguably too many. But hoo boy, I have not seen a film like this before. That's Diamantino, a very weird film.
Diamantino, available to rent where you rent movies. Well, so my pick, I went to a romantic drama that I had really wanted to see called The Photograph. The Photograph is written and directed by Stella McGee, who has done several movies I've really liked. There was a lower profile movie called Gina the Joneses that she did that I saw at Toronto. She did one called The Weekend with Sasheer Zamedo, which I really liked. This is Issa Rae and Lakeith Stanfield, and the trailers for it were very just like luscious and made it look very golden. It's this very swoony romance about this woman who is tracking down the legacy of a photograph of her late mother. And she meets this guy and, you know, it's partly a New York story and it's partly a New Orleans story. This film is like, what I would say about it is mood forward. It has all this kind of golden light, and then it'll have storms and have all this like blue light. It's beautiful to look at, absolutely beautiful to look at. And I have to say, as I was watching this, I was like, this is one of those movies like Roman Holiday with Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn, where part of the reason why you watch it is that you just sit there thinking, these people are so beautiful. Like, these people are so beautiful. They are both gorgeous human beings. And this movie shoots them in this very loving way. It constantly is scored with this like chill sex jazz that I very much enjoyed. It has this undercurrent of tension, but also a knowledge that in the end, this movie is going to turn out okay. It doesn't give you that feeling of that you're about to watch a terrible, like it's going to end like Titanic or something like that. Spoiler alert, Titanic, sad. You have both a sexy romantic vibe and a vibe of kind of hope. I love both of the lead performances. There are times when I think the story could have stood to be built up a little. But one of the things I've always really liked about Stella McGee, and this movie is less like that than her earlier ones, is she's one of those writers and directors who's very, very good with just like shooting just conversations where it's people talking. And even though a lot of the movie is, as I said, really kind of luscious and beautiful, there's also a sequence where the Issa Rae character and the Lakeith Stanfield character are talking to his brother and his wife. And the brother is played by Lil Rel Howery. And so it's these people just all sitting around chatting. And that scene is such a good example of just a scene of a couple becoming a couple through conversations with friends and things like that. I loved that scene. I think the movie is, if you're looking for like a sit down with a glass of wine and just like pull a blanket over you, and like maybe if you happen to be quarantining with a snuggly person that you love, it's so pleasant. And I know that that seems like weak sauce, but I very much enjoyed it. It's a really pretty movie. And as I said, boy, are these people good looking. Unbelievably good looking in this movie.
I mean, Lakeith Stanfield is just so impressive because he is a character actor who can be a lead, right? He's handsome enough to be a lead.
Yeah.
He's compelling enough to be a lead, but he's got a squirreliness to him that allows him to fit into a lot of different roles.
This is really him leaning into his like leading man-osity in the same way that it's a mostly non-comedic Issa Rae performance as well. Mm-hmm. It's kind of for both of them. It's the romantic drama side of their acting. And I just enjoyed it so much. So those are three movies that you can catch up with that we had missed. Tell us which ones you are catching up with right now. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. Tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor StoryPoint Wines, maker of StoryPoint, a bold new wine brand with a rich, layered taste profile. Enjoy StoryPoint Wine while you connect with those you love, either at home or at a virtual happy hour. Raise a glass and share a story. StoryPoint believes that the stories we share can bring joy even in trying times. Visit storypointvineyards.com/happyhour to purchase. Shipping is included in your online order, so consider shipping a bottle to a friend, too.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Steve and Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, shortly after so many of us began quarantining, Gal Gadot released a YouTube video of herself and a bunch of Hollywood movie stars singing John Lennon's Imagine a cappella. And it was roundly panned, roundly made fun of. One of the first things that I really felt united us as a nation was the collective contempt for this video. And it really is painful to watch. Over this past weekend, the cast of Mr. Show, the wonderful HBO sketch comedy show from long ago, reunited to do a Zoom event for charity. So they got together their own all-star cast, not only David Cross and Bob Odenkirk, but people like Rachel Bloom, Fred Armisen, Jack Black, Bryan Cranston, John Hodgman, Bella Fleck, and Abigail Washburn. This wide array of kind of weirdos and comedy adjacent people got together to do a similarly earnest performance of Eat It by Weird Al Yankovic.
Yep.
And what I can tell you about this performance of Eat It is that I would argue that it is exactly as good as Gal Gadot and her friends singing Imagine. It is identically good.
How come you're always such a fussy young man?
Don't want no Cap'n Crunch, don't want no Raisin Bran.
Well, you don't know that other kids are starving in Japan, so eat it.
Just eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
You can find that on YouTube, anywhere. It is very silly. It is very dumb. I would argue, by the way, that Rachel Bloom is the funniest one because she performs her bit while sitting in like a hot tub. And I think that plugged into part of what everyone hated about the Imagine performance, which was that it was a bunch of movie stars in their mansions imagining a better life.
And saying that we're all in this together.
Right.
That's the thing that was most galling. Yes.
And so this, I think particularly Rachel Bloom in that hot tub really captures the spirit of Imagine. Anyway, that's a cast of thousands singing Eat It.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what are you bringing this week?
All right, Captain Bringdown over here. Fred Willard passed away last week at the age of 86. And I think one of the reasons it hit so hard is that because that guy hadn't slowed down. He put the working in working actor, and I had no idea. You check out his IMDb page. That is a CVS receipt, that thing. That is just goes on and on forever. Mm-hmm. His comic persona was, if you think about it, very specific, very him. One of a very performative, very intentional corniness. that was knowing and completely in on the joke. So you see this, I think, most purely in A Mighty Wind. He plays Mike LaFontaine, yeah, the manager of the New Main Street Singers. This guy, in a lot of his roles, is just a dad joke made flesh. But he's a hip dad joke, which, you know, that's not a thing. That doesn't exist in the world. That's not a thing that occurs in nature. And that's how you know he was, there was no one else like him. No one else had carved out that particular comedic space, that piece of comic real estate. So he wasn't your cheesy uncle who likes whoopee cushions and Billy Bass. He was parodying your cheesy uncle while embodying him in a way. Yeah. So I think he spoke to the squareness within us all, the basicness within us all. I think we recognized ourselves and our dads in him. I went back and watched several clips of Fernwood Tonight on YouTube, which is the fake local talk show he did with Martin Mull. It was created by Norman Lear that brought him to national attention back in the 1970s. And that thing is fascinating to watch as a piece of comedy anthropology. Nobody else was doing exactly what that was, whatever the hell that was. But man, you can tell Willard is fully formed from the jump. He is completely committed to the bit. He plays Jerry Hubbard, the announcer sidekick, just a doofus. And that guy walked so Hank Kingsley could run. And in terms of a recommendation, you could just do any of the Christopher Guest films, but he's got maybe 30 seconds of screen time in as an army morale officer in This Is Spinal Tap, who is just squareness personified, but he makes such a huge impact with that time. He gets the most screen time in Waiting for Guffman. But for me, Best in Show is a great showpiece for him because he plays a dog show announcer who is genially obnoxious. There's that contradiction again. There's that thing that he nailed. And there's so much layers to it because you can tell in just a few lines that this is a guy who got a gig and has done no prep work at all. And it's such a funny, warm, but biting performance. So yeah, check him out in Waiting for Guffman or Best in Show and in This Is Spinal Tap. Just do whatever you can, but he is sorely missed.
Yeah, Best in Show is the one that I went back and watched after I heard that he had died. The thing I love about that performance is that it's fully formed, like you said, in that kind of like he has utter confidence at all times. Yes. On Twitter, I called it goober swagger. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely confident. But also, it builds. It builds. It builds. Uh-huh. It gets a little weirder and weirder and weirder. And it's not until fairly far into his performance in that movie that he says maybe the most famous line he has in that film, which is like, how much do you think I can bench press?
Let me ask you a question. This may be a little bit off the path. How much weight do you think I could bench press? Just make a guess. Ballpark figure.
Absolutely.
315 pounds. I mean, I was in top shape. I don't know if I could make it down to the end of this arena and back. Now, deadlifted over 500.
If he opened with that, it wouldn't work. He has to work. You have to work up to the weirdness of how much do you think I can bench press from starting off with the sort of like, oh, ho, ho, why are they grabbing him under the, you know, undercarriage of the dog? Like, I wouldn't want to go on a date with her. Like, it has to start somewhere relatively normal. And this is obviously the writing as well. But his performance just, like, amps up to that. Oh, my gosh, it's so funny. I enjoyed it so much. And I agree with you that Best in Show is a good pick or any of the other Christopher Guest. So, again, what is making us happy this week sometimes is genuinely happy and sometimes is just given a sad event, what you can make of it. And so very close to the time that we learned that Fred Willard had died, we also learned that Lynn Shelton had died. And she was a writer and director and actress. She was 54. She died of a blood disorder that they had been unaware of previously. What I really admire about Lynn Shelton is that she was somebody who, on the one hand, was a very kind of indie director. She made these movies like Hump Day and Sword of Trust. But she also was a working, you know, when you said put the working in working actor, she also really put the working in working director, particularly in television. She had a remarkable resume on television. The first TV directing gig she had was on Mad Men. She directed on, you know, everything from New Girl and The Good Place to several episodes of the recent adaptation of Little Fires Everywhere. She just was an incredibly versatile director who was, you know, I think one of the leading women directors in terms of people who had really established themselves in television on a lot of different shows. She did a lot of work in collaboration with the Duplass brothers, with both of them in different projects. The thing I want to single out is a movie that she wrote and directed called Your Sister's Sister, which stars Mark Duplass and Emily Blunt and Rosemary DeWitt. And there's a sequence in that film, and I always think that it's the opening of the movie, but it's not. It happens about 15 minutes into the movie, where Mark Duplass and Rosemary DeWitt meet in this cabin in this very kind of unexpected, weird way. And they sit down and have a conversation at like a kitchen table. And it is such a perfect sort of, when I talked about Stella McGee and just the people who know how to write and shoot a very natural conversation where it's just people talking, but it's also fascinating. There's this push and pull between these two characters as they sit and have this conversation. Not every story choice in that movie made sense to me. It drove me a little bit bonkers by the end. But that scene is one of my favorite scenes from kind of indie films of the last probably 20 years. It's such a good sequence. And it's romantic comedy, but it's also just humanity. She left behind just a remarkable body of work that I admire enormously. And again, that recommendation was Your Sister's Sister, rentable as a lot of the films we've talked about today, wherever you rent your movies. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Think about subscribing to our newsletter, if you would. It's over at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all back here next week. We're going to talk about a new movie, The High Note. We'll see you then.
On Bullseye this week, Tina Fey. On creating Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, 30 Rock, and being the best at everything.
There was a window of time when we would just go to awards things and pick up our prizes and party with the people from Mad Men.
That's this week on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.